On episode 42 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss ethical email, backup strategies, how to learn new programming languages, and dealing with underperforming developers from IT Conversations.
Hey, okay, Joel, how long have you worked with me now? Do I strike you as the type of person that's going to file my taxes like the first day I possibly can? Does that strike you?
Point.
Is it all possible?
No, that doesn't strike me. Also, remind me to tell... You're right, that makes no sense.
Sorry. Okay.
You're like, is there a day between April 15th and April 16th that I can use?
Exactly. It's bad. Sad but true.
Also, we should remind our listeners. We should remember to tell our listeners that we need an underwriter for this show.
Oh, right.
That's
true.
Who was our previous underwriter? Oh, we can't mention them.
It was the host, wasn't it?
Yeah, we can't mention them because they stopped underwriting us. Well, you know, it ran out. So we need somebody to underwrite. This is sort of like NPR. It's all these bandwidth costs and stuff are just being absorbed by the Conversations Network. And if you're interested in underwriting the show, you'd get a little announcement at the beginning, and it's really, really appreciated. So contact us. Go ahead and. Email podcast at stackoverflow.com, and I'll forward it to the appropriate people, who are, of course, Doug Kay.
Right. Yeah, and the Conversations Network, I mean, just to be clear, and I still think a lot of listeners don't get this, it truly is a nonprofit organization. So
yeah, it's
they're
like
doing this for the greater good of the world. So
and they're
getting
trying.
Somebody to underwrite it actually brings you this content for free. I mean, they're not
for
out
free.
To make a profit. They just want to cover their costs.
Right. And it's not really an advertisement either. It's just sort of an announcement at the beginning saying this is, you know, like they have on public radio.
That's right.
Okay. Anyway, there, I said that. We did it at the beginning. Now we can get on to the news of Stack Overflow.
Yes. So some Stack Overflow happenings. We actually did finally roll out email support in a very basic, rudimentary way. It's working. So the way it's working now, and I think I'm going to make some changes to this today, actually. If you haven't been to the site in 7 days, we can see that. And if there's been activity on your stuff, in other words, people have responded to your questions or commented on your posts, we will email that information to you every 7 days. So that's current default behavior. But I do want to offer people, like at the time they're answering, particularly when they're signing up for the first time, I want that checkbox of like notify me by email of any updates to this question. I want to give people a way to opt in because I did something a little bit unorthodox, I guess you'd say, with the email in that in order to test it and also to sort of rekindle a relationship with people that haven't been to the site in like multiple months, I kind of turned it on for people that hadn't been to the site in a long time.
Yeah, that sounds like that you would get the death penalty if you did something like that.
Yeah, I know. I realize it was a little morally ambiguous, and I apologize. But the thing is, for these people that have been gone that long, they don't even know they had that option, right? It wasn't really available to them. Plus, we're only sending them like stuff, direct responses to them. This is in no way a marketing email for us. This is just your activity on your stuff. Because
so
I actually
if
get that
there
from,
was no activity on your stuff, you would not get any email.
You would not get an email. You only get an email if there's actually activity on your stuff since the last time you had been to the site. But I do want to make it more visible so you can opt in so we don't have to do that. And that was a one-time thing, to be clear. We also have a one-click unsubscribe. Like, literally, it's one click. You click, and then bam, you're done. No, take a survey. And have you ever gotten those email unsubscribe things where, like, you click unsubscribe, and then it's, like, the form that's, like, the voting ballot in Palm Beach in 2000? You know what I'm saying?
They want you to log on. And you're like, log on.
Well, it's like it's like a double negative. It's like, do you not want to not get any more email again? You're like, what?
And then the choices are cancel and maybe.
Okay, or cancel. You're like, what does this mean? Yeah. I actually went through and I unsubscribed from a bunch of stuff recently on one of my other email addresses, which does work, by the way. A lot of people say for spam email, if you go in and unsubscribe, then that just means they send you more mail. But for most reputable companies, that is not, in fact, true. So in order to reduce the volume, I went through and I clicked like 10 different companies unsubscribe. And only one or maybe two, had the true one-click unsubscribe, which I thought was just unconscionable. You know, it's like, how can you not have a one-click unsubscribe? Why even make me take a survey or figure anything out or just do it?
You know? I'll tell you what happens is that, well, first of all, this just slime balls. But the other thing that happens, if you just have a one-click unsubscribe, is you better have a resubscribe right there, because people will click that link by mistake and then be like, oh, no, I unsubscribed. And then they'll call you because they'll panic.
You've actually had this happen?
Sure, because every Joel on Software email has two links. It's got a link to the article and a link to unsubscribe. And people are like, oh, yeah, Joel on Software. And they're just so giddy. Their hands are shaking, and they click on that unsubscribe link. And then they're like, uh-oh. Yeah. So what we do is we do unsubscribe you on the spot. And then below it says, if you unsubscribe by mistake, you can resubscribe right now. Don't worry. And a lot of people do resubscribe right there because they've unsubscribed by mistake.
This begs the question. Why not just include the article? Why make them click through at all?
What do you mean?
I mean, it's not like you guys sell advertising.
Why isn't the article in the email?
Yeah. Yeah, why?
I don't know. It's always sort of, you know, the article might have pictures. And I guess I could send HTML mail.
You can do that. Yeah, that works. I mean, you usually have an extra click to enable the images, but it totally works. I don't know. That's what I would recommend. Just send them the article, particularly because you guys aren't really selling advertising, so you don't really need them to go back to the site. So,
I actually, if they go to the site, they might hang around, click on some other links.
Oh, I see. Now you've become one of the scammy. I see how.
No.
It's a very fine line,
scammy.
Isn't it, sir?
You're the one who's force subscribing all kinds of innocent people.
I did do that, and I apologize. But you know, the funny thing is, I didn't get a single complaint, which was good. And it's a one-time thing. To be clear, I'm not going to go through and turn anybody else on. It was just these people who haven't been in a long time. And plus, like, to be honest,
they did
like,
sign
I wanted
up with their email address. And when somebody
signs
up,
I wanted to make sure.
Yeah,
it was work.
Yeah.
I need to make.
But you could have tested it with like me.
Well, we did. Obviously, we tested it with ourselves.
I think that if you have if you have provided your email to a website in order to sign up for an account, that getting an email from that website is not really spam. You did sign up, you gave us your email, and you're getting something about the website. That's not spam.
Well, I think it's like so many other things. It's kind of like advertising. You know, if you do it in a tasteful way, I don't think people mind. It's just that so many people screw it up and do it in the most obscene, horrible way possible.
Yeah, but I mean, there are principles of like what constitutes spam. And I think, you know, having a relationship with the organization and having provided your address to them and getting a notification about something about the organization not trying to sell you something else are all kind of mitigating factors. So that's probably why you didn't get complaints. Plus, it didn't matter because it went right in their spam folders.
Right. Well, speaking of that, we did have to enable, Jeff Dalgas taught me about this, the reverse PTR record, which is something at the ISP level. You have to actually call your ISP or email them.
You shouldn't
and
have.
Set
I mean,
this
it's
up.
Just a DNS thing. It's just in DNS, isn't it? Oh,
but it's at the ISP level, though, that you don't have access to their
The ISP has to do reverse
console.
DNS.
Yeah.
So your IP address has to be reverse lookupable into the same thing as something that DNS says is indeed your. Yeah. That's a most ISPs. Right. Our ISP certainly just has a console we can use to plug in that information.
Oh, cool. But yeah, I didn't know that. And it sounds like that's like the number one thing that sets you apart from the average spam mail. So you actually have a valid reverse PTR record that can be looked up and validated.
Yeah.
Say, okay, you actually did send this email.
There's a lot of people that, you know, there's a whole industry. It's called the deliverability industry that specializes in all the things and tricks you have to do to get your email through spam filters.
Right. Oh, it's not easy. It's the whole spam war. There's a lot of collateral damage, to put it mildly.
One thing which I do just to at least get through, especially when you're emailing programmers, put something that's a keyword in the subject that's unlikely to be a keyword in spam. So in my case, it's Joel on Software in square brackets. Something that people can write regex so they can whitelist you or so that they can train their Bayesian filter that this is good.
Right. Well, that's why we title ours Viagra. That's the title.
with a backtick instead of an I.
Yeah, with a backtick and a bunch of, elite, elite speak words.
Use a Spanish initial exclamation point, upside down exclamation point. The I.
Viagra from Stack Overflow. Why isn't our mail going through? I just don't understand it. You know, I pity the people. Say you work for a company, you actually have to talk with somebody about Viagra via email. It's like, how would you even do it? Like, you can't send email. It would be, that's
I had
email.
A lot of trouble getting a mortgage, actually.
Exactly. So that's email. That's working
email.
Pretty well.
Awesome. Terrific.
I'm going to hopefully enhance that a little bit. I did improve the login page experience a little bit, try to make it a little more seamless with a lot of the OpenID stuff that's coming along. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you know who's doing OpenID really well now is Google.
Yeah, because it's just there. It's just a URL. You don't have to have your URL. It's just a URL.
That's right. That seems to be the emerging standard.
That's
is
cool.
You use the URL of the provider. Like Yahoo is now doing this. Yahoo. You just type yahoo.com, press enter, Yeah. And then you get taken to a Yahoo login. Or if you have the right cookies in place, you literally, it's totally seamless.
But Google's is like Google slash the number.
Yeah, Google's is kind of crappy.
Yeah.
It's kind of crappy.
Yahoo's
it's
like is just yahoo.com?
Yes. Whoa. And eventually, for Google, it's going to be gmail.com. That will be the valid OpenID address for any user. Just hasn't gotten quite there yet.
They don't want to put the header. They don't want to put the header. They don't want to waste the bytes on google.com to put a header in the HTML page to make
it's still beta. And you know who's still beta that's really frustrating me is Windows Live technically supports OpenID now, but it's in private beta. And I need it to come out of private beta. And I was just talking about this on Twitter and nobody had a good answer, but I need to get some feedback from the Microsoft guys about when they're actually going to go public with that. Because we have essentially one-click links for Yahoo and Gmail that basically type in that URL for you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you don't have to remember it. You just click the picture mm-hmm. on the login page now, which is nice. Now, I would love to do the same thing for Windows Live, which covers Hotmail and stuff, right? So just still waiting for them to get their
Hotmail
act together.
How many users do we have?
It's true that people
have live accounts. Because they have to get MSDN and all that crap. Every friggin' time you try to read a Microsoft Knowledge Base article.
Right. Right, so that's good. The other thing that I did is I finally got around to implementing the what I call the specialist badge, which is essentially tag-based badges. Like if you're really, really active in PHP badge, or in the PHP tag, for example, mm-hmm. you're answering tons and tons of questions, getting lots and lots of upvotes, eventually you'll get a badge award for PHP.
Oh, cool. Who got that one?
We had, I think, 19 users. I did silver and gold level. So it's either 400 or 1,000.
They're like different kinds of tags down at the bottom.
Yeah. I put them at the bottom because they got a little crazy if they were part of the normal sort order. Mm-hmm. But this is a way of rewarding people for, you know, who participate heavily in certain areas of the site and to sort of emphasize, hey, this person really knows a lot about C# or Python or Java or whatever. You know, they're particularly mm-hmm. expert in, as judged by upvotes, which is reasonably accurate. Now, one thing I did have to do that was funny was when I first wrote this algorithm, I basically just loop through, literally. Like, I get a very narrow subset of every answer on the site, like just the columns that I need. Mm-hmm. And then I literally loop through it, calculating, you know, who's active in which tag and so on and so forth. This happens very, very rapidly. The query to get the data is like 1.4 seconds, and then it's another second and a half to just loop through it all. But it's a one-pass algorithm, which is nice. So I can solve the whole problem in one pass. And when I first did this, I hadn't excluded any answers other than deleted answers. Mm-hmm. And I got the really crazy results in that I was giving people badges for, like, off-topic and subjective and fun.
There's three people with subjective right now.
There's some that made it through, but it was much worse because what I did was I ruled out community wiki. So anything marked community wiki, which is 30 answers or more, or a certain number of edits. There's various ways you get forced into community wiki, but community wiki ends up being shorthand for stuff that isn't really detailed programming question, in our opinion. It's more of a discussion type question. You know? So once you rule those out, it was a lot cleaner. We still have three subjective silver badges, but it's nowhere near what it was. I mean, at the point where I'm awarding badges for fun... Literally, there's a badge called fun, and you got a gold badge in fun. It's like, I don't think that's sending really the right message about what we want to reward on the site. Not that I don't want people to have fun. I just don't think they should get badges for it necessarily. No. So that was a little tweak, but other than that tweak, it appears to be working well.
Do you think you should give? I mean, there's some categories that maybe, like I'm thinking perhaps Excel VBA, where there isn't quite enough activity for an expert on, let's say, hypothetically, Excel VBA.
This is a very good point. You know who brought this up in the comments was Greg Hugel. And Greg is like, I think, ranked second or third on the site in terms of reputation. He had a great point, which was, why not have a leaderboard based on tags? And you realize I totally have that information. That pass I'm making through all the questions, I have this data structure. It's just a hash table, basically, of like all activity on all tags at that point. So I could totally synthesize a leaderboard based on tags, which would be a lot more fun because it's tag specific. Because you're never going to beat like John Skeet, right? I mean, John Skeet owns the site basically in terms of reputation and stuff. Although there are people nipping at his heels, but you could go in within a very narrow tag like Excel VBA and become the king of Excel VBA, right?
Yeah, I am the king of Excel VBA.
You are? That's what this is about. You just want to get the badge.
I'm sort of like I think I'm sort of a combination. What is it? What do you get when it's a combination of a king and a deity?
Sun god.
Sun god. I am the sun god of the LVDA.
I don't know what that means. Yeah.
But I
think I am
right.
going to do that. I think I'm going to do that. Other people were suggesting make it more of a statistics-based model where you just have a certain degree above the norm, which would be better because you could throw out a lot more badges for various tags that don't necessarily get a lot of traffic. But yeah. I don't know. I think I'd rather just have the passive leaderboard and just show people, here, for any given tag, here's who the leaders are. Here's the top three, top four, top five, mm-hmm. stuff like that. I think I'm going to look at that tonight and see if I can make that happen. The other exciting piece of news you'll be especially excited about. Remember how you're always sort of on my back about backing up our data? Like the idea that if our site goes down for some reason, like you think we should be able to get it back up and like save the data and like not go out of business.
Yeah, what was it? Magnolia went out of business and some kind of...
Well, where's the fun in that, Joel?
Yeah.
I think it's much more exciting if you just go out of business at any given day. You just don't know. You can wake up and be like, "Is today the day we're going to go out of business?" Isn't that more exciting? Don't you think, as a startup?
The thing that happens with these poor guys is that they take their hard drive and they send it off to one of these hard drive recovery services, which takes a week. Mm-hmm. And there's that week where they're like, "Oh, maybe we'll get it back." You just don't know, so they're miserable for a long, long time. Anyway,
right. So what I did, yep. I went out and invested in a network storage unit.
Oh.
I looked at this. So I was thinking about different ways to back up the site.
Yeah.
I looked at Jungle Disk, which is based on S3. And I've used S3, Amazon's S3 before, and I like it. But it turns out for the type of backups we're doing, like we had a sort of a sit down and sort of brainstormed around this, we realized that bandwidth becomes really a problem. Because yeah. bandwidth is still pretty expensive, and plus you don't have that much of it.
Yeah.
So
it's
at
actually,
the point when you're... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we hit that. We finally hit that with Fog Bugs on Demand. We're starting to hit the point where it's taking us a day, half a day to do a day's worth of backups, just with bandwidth.
Right.
And so I think what we're looking into actually is a tape service where somebody will walk by our cage every day and swap tapes and take the tape out and mail it to us or something.
Wow, tapes. People still use tapes?
Tapes. You can get tapes are a good way to do very, very large backups. Yes.
Okay.
How else would you do them?
I don't know. Well, they have like 2 terabyte hard drives now. I mean, how much data are you guys plowing through?
The thing about the tapes is that they get bigger. I don't know what kind of tapes you get out of. I think 1.6 terabytes, I think, is the tape. I don't know anymore. I don't know anymore.
Right.
But historically, the tapes have kept up with hard drives.
Right. I haven't looked at tape in a long time. I just figured in the era of 2 terabyte hard drives, it's like, why even?
So you just get a 2 terabyte hard drive and swap it out every single
time.
Yeah,
just exactly. Or just do it externally via, whatever the external connectors are available.
If there's somebody listening who actually knows like what the economics are and whether it's actually gotten cost effective to use hard drives instead of tapes, could you please call in the show? We'll have the information at the end. Call in and tell us.
Well, actually, I know a little. I don't know about the tape part, but I do know a little bit about the. I had written about sort of the economics of bandwidth. Do you remember Jim Gray,
yeah.
who unfortunately that sad boating accident, which he never returned from?
Right.
They never able to find him, but the guy was a genius, and obviously did a lot of stuff with Microsoft Research, and he had a lot of really interesting, provocative research on how it ends up being more cost effective to like FedEx hard drives.
Yeah, for sure.
Than
FedEx has
to use traditional.
Bandwidth.
Right, it has incredible bandwidth. Obviously, the latency is not good.
Latency will kill you.
Latency will kill you. But we looked at this, and particularly for our usage pattern, because our backups are, about 5 gigs like right now, and they compress down using 7-zip to about 800 megabytes. But if we're doing that every day, which we typically do, it just adds up to a lot of bandwidth that we're kind of wasting. So we thought if we had a network attached storage unit, a 1U, mm-hmm. And it has RAID and has 4 hard drives in it, we can just copy the backups over and over. And the odds of the data center going kablooey are really, we think, pretty low. I mean, I guess the data center could go down, like something traumatic could happen to its network connectivity, like a backhoe could cut its... But in that case, we're just hosed.
Well, data centers have burned to the ground. Wouldn't be the first time.
Yes,
I would have. Right. I would send Jeff by there once a week or something to just pick up a disk or something.
That's what we're doing. So we're using the network attached storage. We can be really aggressive because we're doing local backups now, so we can back up like crazy locally. We'll have like a terabyte of backup space on this one U storage unit that we're getting. We'll just have tons of backups, and then every so often, every month or bi-monthly, Jeff will just walk by with and Jeff lives very close to the data center, to be clear. I'm not making him drive multiple hours to do this. Take his little USB hard drive and just copy
a couple weeks. Oh, hard drive. I was thinking he's got a little thumb drive.
He has a portable tape unit. He hooks that up. No, a little USB hard drive. So I thought you'd be excited to know.
I've got an image of Jeff Doggess driving all night wearing a diaper to try to get to the data center and recover the hard drive before it's too late. Doesn't want to stop.
Wow.
I don't know why I thought of that.
Wow.
That was just the image that came to my head.
Yeah, but I got kind of geeked out a little bit over this whole network storage market. Like, I hadn't really looked at this before, but there's all these consumer-level network-attached storage devices now, like Drobo. Have you heard of Drobo?
Yeah, Drobo is good because they have their own software for RAID instead of using the traditional RAID, so it will work when the hard drives are different speeds, different sizes, where traditional RAID really kind of wants every hard drive to be identical. And if you have, like, a large hard drive and a small hard drive on a traditional RAID array, it'll just make the large one small so that it can treat them as identical.
Right.
Whereas,
right. It's really kind of, and there's all this bleed over. There's all these people getting these devices that you would normally see in a data center that do RAID and all this stuff, like in their house.
Yeah.
Right. Just average geeks wanting to do this stuff.
Yeah. It's mostly the heavy video production, the video producers. You always have, racks and racks of Drobos because then they can throw any old crappy hard drive that they have on there.
So the device that we ended up with is running like a little embedded Linux. It's got 512 megs of memory, 8 megs of flash, and it's got 4 hard drive bays, and it's just a little embedded Linux. It has a web interface and gigabit Ethernet, and of course to us it'll just show up like an NTFS hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was really neat. It ended up being like $800 for the device, and then of course the hard drives, the cost of the hard drives. And it is true RAID. We're going to use RAID 6, so we can have 2 drive failures. And it's hot plug, and you can plug and play, and
wait,
just
RAID
slap
6, is that a thing?
RAID 6 is a thing. There's all these RAID variants. I know we talked about this a little bit before.
Yeah, but I didn't know RAID 6. I think you're making that up.
No, I think it's real.
I know there's 0, there's 1, there's 5, there's 10.
It's a way of having 2 drives fail. One of the critical flaws of RAID 5 is that, particularly as drives get really large, say you had 4 2-terabyte drives. Mm. Well, it takes a long time to recover a 2-terabyte drive. It's just laws of physics, right? You can't write 2 terabytes of data that fast. So if anything happens to your array, like during the rebuild, it's really bad. Like if you have like another drive fail. But with RAID 6, and I think they basically just do it in parallel. So it's like RAID 5. It's kind of like RAID 10 we talked about. Remember?
Yeah, that's 4 better than RAID 6.
You just do it basically twice. So then you end up having 2 RAID 5s going on so that you can have 2 drives fail at the same time, basically. That's the main reason to do it. So I think we'll have a very good backup strategy in place. That's going to arrive today, so I'll get to configure that and ship it out. And then I'll have Jeff install it.
So I can just imagine the kids today saying, I have RAID 12. Who better than RAID 10? We could make a product and just call it RAID 24, and it would sell like crazy.
I have actually done a ton of research on RAID, and there are just all these crazy variants, like RAID 2. Nobody, I think, ever uses RAID 2, but there is a RAID 2.
Uh-huh.
So I think some of them just ended up not being practical.
There's one where you don't actually store the data. You only store half of it, and that's RAID RAID 7. It's not that useful.
No, that would be RAID 0.5, right?
RAID 0.5. Okay, you can call it. You want to get fractions in there, no problem. And that's useful if you want to prove that you have the data, but without any kind of risk that it might fall into enemy hands.
Yes. Right. Your data is always broken, so there's nothing to lose at that point.
Right, but we can prove that at one time you had it.
It's all very zen.
If you can recover the original, if you have the original data somewhere else.
Yes.
All right, what else
is new? That's it. I know that was a lot, so I apologize for people that aren't in Stack Overflow, but that's what's going down with Stack Overflow.
Cool.
Site's been running really – another hardware thing that I have to talk about. So we did have one little weird issue with our database server. So our database server has a real RAID controller. So it's real hardware. Well, actually all of them do, but this is like a fairly substantial RAID controller. It's supposed to be good and, you know, solid and enterprisey and all that crap. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's an IBM product. It's called the ServRAID. It's like, I know, clever little catchphrase there. But I was getting some weird I/O timeouts on it that I couldn't quite figure out. And in playing with it, I realized that there's these two concepts of cache, and you probably know this actually, write through and write back. Are you familiar with these two caching methodologies?
Okay, write through makes sense to me, but I don't know what write back is.
So write through is the simple one, which means you have data in memory and you want it to go to the hard drive.
Right.
So with write through, you just literally write to the hard drive. But the downside of that is you're waiting for the hard drive to do its thing.
Oh.
Right? You have to stop what you're doing on that thread, whatever it is that's executing on the server, wait for the data to be written, and then say, okay, data's written, now I can proceed doing my other work.
Right.
So it introduces some blocking, so it's not nearly as fast, because you're waiting for physical platters to do their thing and write the data, but there's no risk of data loss. You could turn the power off at any time, and you're in some known state in the system.
Okay.
Well, write-back caching is an improvement on that, in that it basically buffers the write to memory, to some sort of memory space. And the thread that's writing the data can return immediately. It's like, oh, I wrote to memory. And it says, okay, I've written to disk, but it really hasn't, right? It's really just written to this cache somewhere. And typically this is done with battery back cache, because you're vulnerable at that point of, like, the server thinks the data is written to hard drive, but it really isn't yet.
I thought this was, like, totally standard. I thought this is why you had to type sync 3 times before you could reboot your Unix computer.
Well, in a lot of low-end RAID controllers.
Like DOS, like 3.0, they told you, like, wait 5 seconds after the last operation before you turn the computer off.
Oh, this is really basic computer science, no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, this is buffering.
No, but I mean, this buffering where the stuff hasn't been written to the hard drive, the physical hard drive, although the application has returned and pretended that it has been written. I thought that was
Well, a lot of the low-end controllers typically do write-through. They do not do write-back. But write-back performs dramatically better because you're not blocking nearly as much on writes. Right. So you get substantially better performance. But the catch-22 for us is that with write-back on, even though the controller supports it, and believe me, I have the latest and greatest drivers on every level in the system imaginable, I would still see some I/O problems where all I/O would block. Like if the write-back cache got busy and full, it would just say, you know what, no more I/O in the entire system for like 3 more seconds, for some, like, several seconds. Literally no I/O in the system at all while it catches up. I know it seems crazy,
but it needs to recover.
Eventually it just gets behind, and I had some conversation with somebody on Twitter actually, who emailed me and said, believe it or not, this is actually somewhat normal for certain RAID controllers to have this behavior. To get far enough behind, they just say, you know what? Stop everything. No more I/O for 3 more seconds. But the downside is for us is, like, that would happen during a database backup, because we're writing like 5 gigs of data to somewhere on the disks. Now we have 2 arrays, and they're different arrays, but they're all running through the same controller, right? So they all have the same bottleneck.
Okay.
So even though we're writing to a separate set of drives, there's this shared bottleneck of the RAID
backups
control.
Would inevitably bring everything to a screeching halt.
Backups would bring everything on the site to a screeching halt for a couple seconds, which is not horrible, but it's not pleasant either. And we could schedule it for, like, you know, 2 in the morning or whatever, but that's still somewhere in the world somebody's going to get timeouts. Mm-hmm. So we fixed in air quotes, by turning off write-back caching, which doesn't affect us too much because we don't really have a lot of disk bottlenecks anyway, and our array performs pretty good even with write-through on. But anyway, a little aside on that, I got to learn about sort of the mechanics of write-through versus write-back and, you know, just the evils of blocking. You know, if blocking, you have to block somewhere in the system with any software, any hardware you're developing. It's just a question of where you want to pay the price and for how long, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you think about like how ASP.NET works, you have buffered output. It's the same exact thing, right? You're writing to this output stream, which is the network connection, right? But you don't want to block. You don't want to wait for the network connection to actually transmit the data, so you buffer.
Well, that's not what you can't buffer
forever.
Is it? I thought the reason you buffer is because later, halfway through the page, you're going to decide that you want to change some HTTP header somewhere because of the way the programmer wrote their code.
I'm not sure. I mean, typically, you can't really go in and mess with the previous contents of the buffer, can you?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can set HTTP headers at any point.
Well, headers, but that's a different thing. Yeah, and actually,
Were sent. That was the first thing that you sent. That would have been the first thing that you sent. So if you're not blocking, you already sent the headers. It's too late to mess with them.
But I know there's exceptions based on that, where if you try to set the headers after a certain point, you get an exception where it's like, oh, sorry, those headers are already set. You can't depending on where you are in the life cycle of the output. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'll have to research it. But there's a bunch of caveats around it. But the whole concept of buffering is really fundamental and just avoiding blocking, right, based on some bit of hardware. And Ethernet, you know, network connection, that's hardware. And actually, if you look at a lot of the really high scalability discussions, it's funny how much of them boil down to, let's put everything in memory. Mm-hmm. Because when you do everything in memory, you can almost never block. I mean, memory is one of the fastest things you have. It's faster than disk. It's faster than network, right? So the concept of blocking is almost non-existent for memory. It's tiny.
Well, it's really a question of whether you have a slow thing and a fast thing. That's what causes the problems, is that you're doing something fast and then something else slow.
But you always have something fast and something slow, right?
But you've got like your cache on the CPU chip. That's even faster than the regular memory, and the CPU right. will indeed stall when it's waiting to write out its cache from the CPU, right? Like at some point that fills up and it stalls.
Right. Right. So, no, absolutely. There's tiers of this to be sure. But
right.
Memory is, I think, where the game is being played now, because, you know, our server, I put 24 gigs of memory in it for $600, right? So you're starting to get these huge playgrounds for memory where you can actually have very, very large databases in memory, whether you're doing it like Google.
You could possibly, with 24 gigs, I think you might be able to open Visual Studio and Excel at the same time.
It's
I don't know. I haven't tried it.
Yeah.
Let's take some questions.
Let's do that.
All right, here's one.
Hi, I'm Michał Tatarinowicz from Poland. I'm a web developer. I usually code in PHP. I want to learn a new language to improve my skills. My question is, what language would you guys suggest I learn? It doesn't necessarily have to be useful for web development, although it would probably help. Thank you.
Yeah, what language?
Well,
I'll learn.
I'm encouraged that he's getting off PHP, because
we got all kinds of hate mail from something I don't think we even said intentionally in the last show.
I probably said it intentionally. I'm really down on PHP and it's funny for me to be a language snob coming from, you know, Visual Basic, which was looked down on for years and years.
But it's the same thing. But you know what? There are certain languages that are easy for whatever reason. They're perceived as being relatively easy. And therefore, they attract an audience of people who are relatively inexperienced and are not familiar with, shall we say, good programming practice, whatever that may be. They don't have the solid principles tattooed to their forehead in reverse so that they can see them in the mirror every morning. And they learn these languages and then they write awful code because they just, you know, have not been taught any better. They just don't have the skill, the mad skills. And at any given time, there's some language where all the young Turks are doing the crappiest work. And, you know, for a long time, it was Basic and Visual Basic. And then for a while, it was, VBScript and PHP. And now it's PHP, I think, really. It's just easy enough. JavaScript in web pages, you know, where people just, they cut and paste things. And eventually, they learn how to modify that loop. And then they cut and paste some more things, and the code is just kind of ugly, and they don't even know what they're doing when they look at it. So that's why I think these languages get bad reputations that are undeserved. I think that when a good software engineer looks at these languages, they can find a way to use it. They can find a way to use almost any programming language and write good, clean, solid code.
Right. So with regards to this specific question, you know, which direction should you go? I think any direction you go from PHP is going to be a good one. I'm not just saying that because I sort of dislike PHP, but because if you look at the hallmark of really good programmers, they all know multiple languages. I think it's easy to specialize, and you should specialize to some degree, right? You want to be good at – you can't be good at everything, at least not unless you're like, you know, a Renaissance man or whatever, but – just simply the act of trying to learn another language will make you better at your original language, I think, because you get out of the mindset of the paradigm of the blinders you have on that you don't even see. So I would say any language, ultimately.
How about
I would say,
come on, that's not an answer. Excel VBA. There's your answer.
But he might compete with you on Stack Overflow if you learn Excel
VBA. I'll be happy to answer any questions he has as he goes along with Excel VBA. Come on, you got to pick something, Jeff. You can't just say any language. That's nonsense.
Well, you know, we use C#, so it'd be easy for me to say C#, and particularly ASP.NET MVC, because I feel MVC
is a really
is
good language for learning. more stuff?
Well, if you look at the classic paradigm of sort of the Java type languages that are, you know, classical C-like programming language that are managed, have managed memory.
Right.
I would say either Java or C-sharp would be a logical place to go. And then from there, something more dynamic, you know, like Python, Ruby sort of thing. But there might be some value in getting additional structure from C-sharp or Java, and then tearing away that structure and going back to the dynamic languages might be an interesting progression to make. I think it's a progression a lot of developers make, so maybe that's the logical steps to follow.
All right, well, I'm going to have to disagree with you on this one.
Okay.
Because those are boring languages. You can figure those languages out. They're easy. I would pick a language that's going to teach you something that you haven't learned from PHP and that you probably won't learn in C#.
Is it C? Are you going to say C?
Well, I was actually going to start with Haskell.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's a learning language. It's not something to use. It's something to broaden your vocabulary of what programming languages do and just kind of stretch the parts of your brain. Because basically, you know, there's sort of the universal language of what an algorithm can be and how to express algorithms and how to translate. Yeah, let's call it I don't even know what I'm talking about, the universal language of algorithms. And all these programming languages that we're speaking of only expose a subset of those capabilities to you. And so if you've only learned one language, the problem is that you have a very, very constrained idea of how to do things that's based on your only knowing the way that your language exposes how to do those particular things. And so, for example, I can think of a million examples, but if you have a list of things and you need to do something to everything in the list, then a language like PHP is very much going to orient you around making a loop. And so you're going to try to figure out, how do I get the first item in the list and the last item in the list, and how do I make a loop over those items and do something to each one of them? Whereas, for example, if you were doing this in Python, there would be this Python way of doing it called a list comprehension, where it's just something that's sort of built into the language. Or if you were doing it in Haskell, for example, there would be a recursive way of doing it, or maybe you'd make a map. You'd use a map function. And so the idea of doing something to everybody in a list is something which different programming languages expose in different ways, and probably the best way to become a best programmer in the languages that you have to work in, because at some point you may just have to write PHP or have to write JavaScript, is to at least learn the languages that do things in kind of, you know, very different ways. Maybe, you know, so I'm thinking like maybe Forth, which is very stack-oriented, C, which is very pointer-oriented and kind of low to the hardware, Assembler for a little bit just to kind of learn about what goes on at the chip, Haskell, Lisp. These are all languages that do things in ways, and Python and Ruby, what the heck. All languages which do things in ways that are very, very different. Whereas, for example, C# and Java, you can go back and forth between C# and Java and never learn a single thing. Like if you were a bloody expert at C#, and then you studied Java, you would not learn a single new underlying concept. So I'm gonna go. What was my first thing? Haskell, right?
I have a problem with that. I mean, isn't that like telling them to learn like Latin? It's like, I want to learn some language. Like, well, learn Latin. I mean, it's just not very practical, is it? I mean,
yes, it's very practical. Practical. You're not learning languages. He doesn't want to learn a language so that he can program in one more language, so that like if he gets the job and they happen to be using Haskell, that he can speak it. He's learning a language to broaden his brain so that when he writes code in whatever language he writes code in, his code is more elegant and more expressive and more and cleaner, and he can come up with better algorithms and he can think of more concise ways to solve problems.
Wouldn't it just kind of blow your mind to go from PHP to Haskell in one fell swoop?
Isn't that the goal of learning, to blow your mind?
That's not how I learn. How you learn. But I learn very iteratively. Like, I need to learn one thing at a time, then the next thing, then the next thing.
How did you learn how to swim? Can you swim?
Yeah, I can swim.
But did somebody throw you in the water at some point and say, swim, boy?
I don't even remember how. I remember learning to ride a bicycle, though. I remember that moment of just...
So what's the... There's no step-by-step. At some point, it's got to blow your mind a little bit. Otherwise, you're not learning. I mean, if you think of learning as like, wow, I learned one more... You know, API, one more useful string manipulation function that I had never heard of. Oh, this is useful. I will commit this to memory. That's not really learning. That's just like adding vocabulary.
I guess. I don't know. I don't like this Big Bang approach to learning. I don't.
Haskell is not.
I just don't work that way.
People learn it in 1 week in classes in school, where you have three lectures and, you know, maybe 12 hours of homework, and they've learned Haskell. It's not. It's not like it's gonna make your. I mean, your head will explode. It's true, but it's not like it's gonna take 6 months of sweating when you come out of it. It's nothing like Latin, because Latin, first of all, you're learning a bunch of junk, a bunch of grammar that nobody cares about anymore. And it's going to take you a year to learn, you know, a little bit of Latin. But these programming languages, they have, you know, three or four metaphors and you're done. You know, with Lisp, there's no syntax. Lisp is taught in like the first 4 minutes, or it's really Scheme, the Scheme dialect of Lisp, is taught in about the first 4 minutes of that famous Abelson and Sussman video.
I'm going to have to find that for the show notes, the famous video that you're referring to.
It's a video, it's a series of videos of MIT, the Introduction to Computer Science, or whatever it's called, that's taught at MIT, a class that was called 6.001. And
right.
there's a kind of old video you can get I think it's Henry Abelson teaching it at Hewlett-Packard, and they videotaped it. And he's taught you everything about Scheme by, I think, about a quarter of the way through there. And he's already teaching you advanced concepts using Scheme. And it does sort of blow your mind. And the truth is, I think a lot of people just do blow up and need to go back and watch it again and again and again and get some help. But all of the syntax is just left parenthesis, a function, and then the arguments, and then right parenthesis. That's it. Now you know the whole language. And
right.
What it does is it evaluates the arguments, which are everything but the first thing inside the parentheses. And then it evaluates the first thing in the parentheses, which has to evaluate to a function, which already blows some people's minds that something can evaluate to a function, especially PHP programmers. And then you pass those arguments to that thing.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's interesting how the Big Bang approach to learning is so appealing to you and so non-appealing to me. But I guess
there's a Big Bang. There's a big concept here you got to learn. You're just going to have to get over that. You know. It's not that big. The thing is that there are concepts that are there in C, in Haskell, in Ruby, and Python. Although Ruby and Python pretty much share most of them, and Smalltalk, of which Ruby is pretty much the modern version. And I'm going to get hate mail for that one. But there are concepts that are in there that are worth learning. And once you know those concepts, you'll write better code in whatever language you have to use, because you'll be trying to emulate those concepts even if the languages don't support them very well.
Right. So your choices are Haskell or C#, Java, depending on
who you like better.
You think would fit your mind better.
There you go.
Right. So do we have another question?
Sure. Let's take one more question here.
Hi, Joel and Jeff. This is Adam from Pennsylvania. I work for a research and development group at a large defense company, and I've been told that my project is ending as of January 1.
This is kind of an old question. we didn't get to your question quite in time. It is, of course, February 15th, 16th.
Right.
Anyway.
And what was the question?
Hi, Joel and Jeff. This is Adam from Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Hi, Joel and Jeff. This is Adam from Pennsylvania.
You told us this.
And I've been told that my project is ending as of January 1. And I've since found new work starting then. But how do I keep my motivation going from now until the end of the year when I know that this project is just going to be put on a shelf and not used? Thanks, and keep doing great podcasts. Bye.
Well, Adam, call us back and tell us what you did, because it took me almost 3 months to get to that question.
Right. He should be telling us how to answer this question.
How to keep your motivation up on the last month of a project that's going to be shelved.
Well, I think it's, at some level, you have to do the work because it's satisfying, right? It's not about the product. I mean, ultimately, hopefully you're shipping a product that meaningfully affects the world in some way, ideally. But even if you aren't, it'll meaningfully affect you. You'll get better as a result of having worked on this product, right? Even if it never ships and nobody ever touches it, you will be a better programmer for having worked on this. You will have learned something.
Just get a friggin' ping pong table at work and just get better at ping pong, and at least you'll be a better ping pong player by the time you're done. And if walks by, just say, hey, I'm not writing code that you're going to put in a box, and I'm out of here on January 1st, so I'm playing ping pong.
Well, one thing that people brought up, I actually read some Hacker News comments on an article I posted recently, and it was about, you know, following rules that other programmers have set down. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you don't necessarily agree with them, like our podcast with Uncle Bob, where we don't necessarily agree with some of that stuff. But part of actually learning is taking the experience of other programmers at face value and saying, okay, I don't know if what you said is true, but I'm going to try it.
I'm going to learn Haskell, damn it. No matter what I think.
or like unit testing. Say you believe unit testing is crap, which I don't, by the way. I'm just saying, for the sake of argument, let's say you believe it's an affront to computing and you hate it.
Okay.
Well, you can't really say that without having tried it, right?
I don't know. I've never – there's all kinds of things I haven't tried. I haven't tried self-immolation. And I'm pretty sure that's
I don't
not
think this
something.
Is quite the same as self-immolation.
No, you don't have to. I don't. I think it is an illegitimate argument to say you did not try that, therefore you are not fit to judge it. I don't think that is a valid
really?
Argument.
I think there's some truth. Well, I think you have to be open to trying things that you don't necessarily believe.
You should be open to trying things that you don't necessarily believe. I'm all for that. But I don't think that it is possible to – if you say – I don't accept your argument on this because you haven't tried it. That's an ad hominem argument. And ad hominem argument.
Really?
Yeah, it's not a legitimate argument. Yeah, it's just
well,
not, it's not
wait,
a valid
wait, wait, wait.
It is not valid to argue by saying the person who is making this argument has not tried it.
Really? Well, I would say that's a fairly valid argument, because how can you have experience in
because
something
if
you haven't
hominem,
actually
Because it's
tried
an argument about the person making the argument. It doesn't address the central point of the argument, which is, does this or does this not work?
But how can you have any informed opinion about whether something works if on some level
you have opinion about all kinds of things? Have you ever been married to a man? Do you have an opinion about gay marriage? I mean, come on. It's perfectly possible to have totally legitimate opinions without having experienced something.
But this is the advantage of being a programmer, is that we can actually have opinions that are based on some kind of data. I mean, there's enough religion in programming
what,
as
okay,
is.
Really, what kind of data is that? That you tried it and it worked for you? The real data would be if you actually did some kind of double-blind experiment. Where both people try, you know, you had two teams that were identical in every way, living in the same universe and building the same thing. And
well, our craft,
it
but wait a minute, software is so exploratory anyway. I mean, there's so many different ways of accomplishing any given thing you want to do in software that nobody can even really tell you if you're right or wrong. So there's all this
true.
Data
well, that
out
is,
there.
I mean, it
tested.
Is very sociological. It's hard to get this data. That's true. But I mean, how much does it add to your argument, really, that you have experience with something, that one person has tried something?
Well, I think it just sets you apart from the people that have not tried it at all. Like you said, the people who have an opinion about gay marriage but aren't gay, it's like, well, I don't know. it does inform the opinion to actually have some experience in it, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it might – you know, when it's a court, you would say if it was a court of law, if it was a trial, you would actually probably say that invalidates your ability to have an opinion on something. For example, a juror will get thrown off a jury with cause if they have experience with either position. I got thrown off of a jury because it was a tenant suing a landlord, and I was managing an old building for my grandmother, so I was technically a landlord. And they said, well, you know, you're obviously, you know, it's bias.
So I see. So you would present the arguments pro and con, and you would be like a blank slate. Like, you had no opinion on this. But if one person gave you the pros, the other person gave you the cons, you could then judge.
I think it is fundamentally not a correct argument to make to say your opinion is invalid because you do not have experience with this thing. I just don't buy that. I think that's like saying that Nancy Reagan shouldn't have an opinion about the war on drugs because she's never done drugs. I mean, it's not a legitimate argument because it's an ad hominem argument. And when you find people making these arguments, saying, well, you're not qualified because you haven't tried it, that's usually because they haven't really – they're not doing a real good job convincing people just on the surface of the arguments themselves. And so they want you to get in there and try their thing, and then you'll see it and your eyes will be opened in some way which they have somehow failed to explain to you. But why are they failing to explain it to you? Is it because they're bad at explaining things, or is it because – which is possible – and if you do try it, maybe you will discover those things that they have failed to explain. Or maybe they're just wrong.
Huh. Right.
That's actually, I think it's in Paul Graham's article. We should come back to we always come back to Paul Graham, how to disagree. Do you know that article? How to disagree on the internet or something. We'll link to it from the show notes.
Right. Well, one observation, though, is there's a lot of people that are speaking from a position of just pure ignorance. So it's like, how do you – I agree with you that you should be persuasive. If you can't be persuasive, even if the person has never tried it and never done anything, if you can't make a persuasive argument, you're sucking, right? You're not
Yeah.
You're not doing a good job of communicating your position. That I agree with completely.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's tough when you make a persuasive argument and people just argue from a position of pure ignorance and just completely disregard, and they're not even open to hearing what you're saying.
Right.
Right.
Agreed.
So I think there's two like sides to that, right? I mean, I think you can be wrong in two dimensions there.
How did
you can be totally ignorant.
Yeah.
Or you can have a crap argument. Right?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, getting back to, I feel bad that we haven't, let me tie this back to the question that was actually asked.
What was the question? What would you do? That's right. What would you do if your project was canceled? How do you keep going? How do you keep motivated?
Right, but you still have to work on it. So I would say try things you haven't tried before and see if you like them, because you know the project's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, you might.
So use it to experiment.
That's right.
Right? Experiment with things that you haven't tried before that might have some value.
Last minute Haskell rewrite of the whole
thing. Yeah, rewrite it in Haskell. You know, do 100% unit test coverage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Make it a learning experience at least.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Make it a learning experience.
There's a sort of similar question, which is something that I was kind of trained in the Army, which is when you're leaving and somebody else is going to take over, leaving and, basically doing all that, you can sort of, if you're in charge of some particular project and you know in 2 weeks somebody else is going to take over and you're going to move on in career either because you're leaving to another job or you're just moving on to a different position in the company or something like that. You know, you certainly have an opportunity to not do all that kind of grimy fatigue, grub work, keeping your code clean and documented and stuff like that. There's a little temptation to just slack off in the last couple of weeks because who cares? You're going to be gone. And obviously the professional thing to do is, really to kind of work until the last minute of the last day as hard as you can, as if it were the beginning of, as if you were on the first day on the job instead of on the last day on the job. And that's just basic professionalism.
Sure, it is. And I think I would also try to turn any project, and it's selfish, but anyone listening to this podcast probably won't be surprised, but any project I've worked on, I've tried to make it into something I thought it should be.
Yeah.
In other words, I try to serve my own interests along with the project's interest, because I feel like they should run in parallel, right? So, like, you can sort of warp the project into what you think it should be and what actually makes sense to you and is actually enjoyable and to work on. I mean, obviously, it's a discussion there about how far you do that. But particularly if the project is dead-ending, you could just totally turn it into whatever you want.
Yeah.
So I have a Stack Overflow question I want us to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do it.
This is a very self-referential one, so please indulge me, and I apologize to anyone who's going to be offended by this. But it's 309-517, and it's when to drink when listening to Stack Overflow podcast. So this is a list of all the things we do wrong in the podcast, which I thought was hilarious. First of all, the drinking game. The first entry in the drinking game is drink whenever Jeff or Joel interrupt each other. We never do that, do we, Joel? Do we interrupt each other? Joel's being extra quiet, I see. And then number two on the list is whatever.
I don't think interrupting is really a problem.
Nicely played. Number two, this is true, I do this all the time. Whenever, after a 10-minute comment by Joel, Jeff leaves 3 seconds of dead air and then says, yeah. And then the next one.
When does that happen you're not paying attention because you're like off searching for jokes about something on the internet, right?
I kind of apologized for that before, but the rationale, you can judge for yourself whether it's true or not. I'm trying to think of the next topic. Like, I don't want there to be dead air, and I want Joel to have his piece, and I don't want to interrupt him, going back to number
but
one.
You're already bored with this subject and moving on to the next one.
Well, I just want to make sure, we're moving it along. We don't have dead air, because that does happen, So, anyway, that's technically what it's for. The third item is whenever Atwood says, actually, drink. And then I said, of course, actually, I don't say actually that much. And then the fourth one, you'll love this. You've already done this. Whenever Joel mentions Excel and VBA, you've already done it.
This is the first time I mentioned it on the show. 42 episodes I went without saying a word.
You just happened to today. What are the odds? I had this one all picked out before we started the call, so you can't say that I did this just to make you look bad. The next item on the list, whenever Joel forgets the dedicated phone number of the podcast, or...
Oh, no, wait, that's it. Well, that's it. I'm bringing it up right now.
Or whenever Joel talks while a user question is playing, which you've already done.
Yeah, but that's because it's like if this were an actual radio show, I would be having a conversation with a listener. But unfortunately, they've recorded their thing and they've now moved on. They're in a different place and time.
Well, Joel talks when I'm talking too, so it's not like they get any special treatment that I get. Mm-hmm. So the next item on the list is whenever Fog Creek's interview process or intern program is mentioned, which I don't think we do that much. And then another one for me, whenever you hear the phrase 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Because everything takes 6 to 8 weeks. I have a PMP certification. And the answer is six to eight weeks for everything that's going to be done.
You know, the transcribers kept writing 68.
68 weeks. Wow. We came in way ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
We're kicking butt. Anyway, that was a fun one. I just wanted to do that one.
All right, how much time do we have? Because I'll come up with one. We got a little bit of time.
We got some time.
We can go over today.
We
can go over today. How to disagree? Okay, don't forget to put that in the show notes. Paul Graham, how to disagree?
Yeah, no,
everybody go
me,
read that. Stack Overflow.
Are you kidding me? Really? You don't have anything picked out?
I had to search Google for Stack Overflow. It came right up. Now, here we go. Favorites. I do have something picked up. Did I flag that, really? Okay, here we go. It's called Tips on How to Inoffensively Help an Older Coworker to Become a Developer Instead of a Code Monkey.
What's the number?
Number is 193141. And the question is, I have an older coworker who has been a programmer for about a year here and just can't seem to break out of the code by the seat of his pants mentality. Is there a good way to help, or after a year of not taking advice, is it best to give up? And the official accepted answer that got the most points was just give him a copy of Code Complaint. This, I think, is not going to work. This does not sound like the kind of person who reads Code Complaint.
I think you'd have to start with a copy of Code Complete and just like pick topics from it and have little, I mean, this is about pair programming, right? I kind of want to blog about this because I feel like the last two blog entries I had were kind of pessimistic about you can't really help programmers that can't help themselves, which is fundamentally true. But on the other hand, people can help each other on a one-to-one basis. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a crappy example from high school, but I think it totally emphasizes the human factor here. We were sitting in this high school English class, and this girl says, "Does anyone have any gum?" Right? And she's just asking the room. She's not asking a person.
Right.
And of course, nobody steps up and gives her any gum.
Yeah.
Then she turns to the person next to her and says, "Joe, do you have any gum?" And he's like, "Yeah, here's some gum."
Yeah.
This is what I'm talking about. Like, you have to have that personal relationship because people don't ignore each other. They ignore.
That's a principle. It's a psychological principle called diffusion of responsibility.
Right.
When she was asking room, the responsibility to answer her was diffused.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what, if you give them a copy of Code Complete, it's like, oh, I'll read it whenever. You know, maybe I'll read it, maybe I won't. But if you sit down and actually go through the principles, like you take your code. And you say, look, here in the book, we're talking about don't repeat yourself. And here we have the same code in two places, right? It's a much more interactive and I think much more helpful on a one-to-one basis. I think that's really the only way to help programmers like that.
This is kind of, you know what? This is sort of an interesting question because it sounds to me like the problem is that this person is not really motivated to be any better. They either think, maybe he thinks he's fine or he thinks he's good enough. But he's just not that into it, and it's not a matter of like, oh, help me here. I think that all these answers, like give him a book and force him to learn and pair programming and all that kind of stuff, sort of assumes that he cares enough. And I think the problem may be one of motivation. Like the guy just does not really care, and he may not care because he thinks. Wait a minute. Okay, I'm saying he, but there's no evidence actually that it's a male older programmer.
Yeah, this person
may or may not care. And if they don't care, there's not going to be anything you can do about it, really. And there are two possible reasons they don't care. One is because they're actually really kind of good, and you're just not noticing it. So, for example, I could totally imagine that the person asking this question is one of these annoying people that goes to the meetings on Tuesday night where you read something out of the Gang of Four book and then comes back and wants to rewrite all their code to use the singleton pattern or whatever and make, you know, and whether or not it's appropriate and is upset that the older programmers, like, can we just write code here, please? We're doing fine. And maybe the older programmer is being very productive. And the younger programmer is the one that's just jumping on every single shiny thing and taking it a little too far. So that's a possibility.
Well, you don't want to be overbearing, because I think you can actually cause harm here, right? If you become very overbearing and very prescriptive, the act of interacting with other people is not easy, right? Any programmer will tell you that.
It's not just pushing
but
your ideas
out. You can cause damage.
Out.
What I would emphasize, you can cause damage, active damage, if you do this the wrong way. So you need to be very, very careful.
Teeth punched out, actually, if I was the older programmer.
Well, you can just make them. I mean, I've worked with other programmers that pissed me off to the point that, like, I would do the opposite of what they told me to do just because they pissed me off. Right?
Teach them. Yeah. So I don't know. This is a kind of question where I don't really know enough about the situation. I generally kind of refuse to answer email that I get like this because there's too many details that if I was actually there, I might be able to pick up on. Does the person care? If the person doesn't care, that's your problem. Making them care.
Yes, and, but how do we fix not caring?
Isolate them. Just don't let them write code. You know, are they writing code? Is it decent? Or do you just want to isolate them and keep them out of the project? Are they writing code that takes more work to fix than otherwise? Then you put them in a rubber room. You know, you give them fake code to write.
So you're saying for the people that actually don't care, the only solution is to cut them out of the project?
No, I mean, they may not care because they believe they're doing a great job, and maybe they actually are. And then you should sort of pay attention to, like, your own. Because I really do feel, we talked about this a little bit on previous shows, and it's sort of been a running theme for a while here. But I kind of feel like there's a spectrum of developer goodness that ranges from completely incompetent to fairly competent. And at the far end of the spectrum, you have developers that are just really, really good without following any stupid rules or patterns or books or any of that kind of stuff. They don't need to be taught about solid principles because they're just doing that stuff naturally. I'm not saying that it wouldn't help, maybe, but maybe it wouldn't. And, you know, there are just some developers, like, you think Linus Torvalds would do better if he just friggin' learned some object-oriented programming? He won't even do object-oriented programming. He's a pure C programmer.
Oh, he's super dogmatic.
He's super dogmatic about his things.
Yeah, about his things, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I don't think anybody would make an argument that he's not an effective or a good programmer. You almost couldn't.
I think some people would. I don't think it would be accurate.
Right, exactly. He's just sort of off the charts. So you know, it is, I actually do feel like there's all these kind of skills that you and I learn from books, like, let's say, Code Complete, and they're awesome, and that's valid at a certain point in your career. And if you really absorb those skills and you get good at them and you continue to practice them, you do eventually get over to the other side of the hump where you are just kind of naturally writing good code without necessarily following any of the strictures. You don't have to sit there very, very carefully and step-by-step do something the step-by-step way that you were taught to do it in Code Complete, because it just sort of comes naturally to you, and you'll do something that's a little bit different this time than exactly the way it specifies it. But it's for a reason, and it's smarter, and it's more better the way you did it.
Well, let me give you an example. So I took this book, Refactoring, like, with me on our honeymoon.
Is that right? Because Martin Fowler.
It was a two week honeymoon, so we had a lot of time. And it's the Fowler book. And I read it, and I remember my reaction to Refactoring the book was like, I'm already doing all this stuff. I mean, there was a little bit of information in it that was useful, but I just felt like anybody who's good at programming doesn't need to read this book.
Yeah.
Which is kind of heretical, right? It's like, well, this is a classic programming book, Refactoring. But I was like, wow, I've been doing this already for years.
All right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, not that I'm a genius and I know everything, but I just didn't feel like it really helped me, that book,
but
at all.
But there are people that would help.
I suppose.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's what it is that there is a spectrum, and you have to sort of decide, is this a quote-unquote older developer who actually is really kind of good at writing code, and maybe you're being a little bit dogmatic about doing things and, you know, concerned more about the form than the usefulness of the things that you want to do, and you're just sort of obsessing about the fact that, you know, he refuses to, I don't know, always put three paragraph comments into the source version control system. Or maybe this is just an unskilled developer that has never become skilled and has been doing this for a long time and just refuses to ever get the skills. In which case, you just have to decide if their code is a net positive or a net negative to your code base.
Well, let me give another example. I've certainly worked with lots of programmers that I felt were kind of lost causes, not in this lifetime, but in previous lifetimes. And one of the ways I looked at approaching those programmers was, okay, right, are they causing harm? Usually they weren't really causing harm. Mm-hmm. They just weren't really helping that much. But one way to look at it is just to get everyone excited about the end result, more so than concentrating, okay, is their code good? Is their code bad? Are we building something that actually works for the client? Is the client actually happy with what we're doing? Are we happy with what we're doing, right? Are we having fun? Is our team enjoying the work that we're doing? Maybe that's a better, more holistic way to look at the situation.
Wait,
because
how does that help if there's some guy on the team that's not helping?
Well, because if they're actually excited about the product, right? If they say, okay, this is a really cool thing we're building that people really like, they'll just, I think, be more engaged with their work on some level, even
so
if they're not going to write
motivated. So you're saying they might have a motivation issue. And
they might have a motivation issue.
If you get them psyched about the direction the project is going, they might be more motivated to do good work.
Right,
that's
exactly.
A very idealistic approach.
It is idealistic. But
I don't know
but
if I've ever seen that happen.
Well, it is idealistic, but I think what I'm trying to recognize is if you sit down with this programmer, you're not going to be able to magically turn them into a good programmer.
Right, right.
So given that you're probably not going to be able to affect the output of their work, what are some more ambient ways you can affect their work?
That is kind of depressing. If they're not motivated, no matter what you do, they're not motivated. If they are motivated, but they're just not smart enough, no matter what you do, they're never going to be smart enough. So there's just a sort of narrow range of programmers that are both motivated and smart enough, and they're already learning the stuff on their own, and they're already getting better every day, and they're writing, you know. And they need at most course correction. Basically, they need to learn an extra skill where you notice a lot of times I'll look at developers and say, wait a minute, I just thought of a skill that you don't have that will make your life better, and I can teach it to you, and you're motivated, and you'll understand it because you're smart, and you'll start doing it, and your life will be better, and all I got to do is teach you this couple of skills here or there.
Right. I mean, it ultimately comes to a question of leadership. You know, if people aren't good coders, it's like you sort of take them off the coding part and put them where they can actually help your team effort, right? Is it right. Writing documentation? Is it actually interacting with the users? Is it? There's a lot of ways to move the project forward that don't necessarily involve hardcore coding too, right?
Testing. No, testing. Yeah. Testing's even worse if they're not motivated. They won't find any bugs. Okay. Yeah. Let's see. Where was I? I guess we're kind of over our time, so I guess I got to find the Stack Overflow phone number now.
Right. You got to forget it like you classically do.
I've never – the only phone number I know was my phone number when I was 6. Jeez, I've forgotten that already. I haven't memorized any phone numbers. They're all on my phone, so I have to look them up every time, including, you know, practically my home phone number. But to be fair, if you have any comments on this show or any other show, what you can do is record an MP3 or Ogg Vorbis file and email it to us at Stack Overflow. Email it to us at podcast and then the at sign, on which is a shift 2 in the United States. Podcast Stack Overflow at, you say it, I can't do it. I can't even say the email address.
Oh, it's podcast at stackoverflow.com.
And the phone number is 646-826-3879. You can call that, record about 90 seconds. Do us a favor, if you're calling the podcast hotline, please spell your name at the beginning.
Yeah.
We won't play it. We'll just spell it so that we can get it right in the show notes. Because otherwise, we're just going to write all kinds of random crap, and that's what people are going to find when they search for you. Also, if you're interested in sponsoring the show, if you or your employer is interested in sponsoring the show, it's kind of like underwriting the show, basically providing a little bit of money. Your name will be mentioned as sort of a charitable cause because the show is entirely not-for-profit and is hosted by the Conversations Network, which is a not-for-profit 501c3, et cetera, et cetera. Please contact us at podcast@stackoverflow.com, and we'll put you in touch with the appropriate people.
Right.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.
Oh, for the love of God. I'm getting all these emails today about, why did you remove my question? You got to see this. Hold on. You can see this because you're a moderator. So let me open a chat window with you. Here. So I just got an email from this guy. Why did you remove my question?
I don't get it. Oh my God, it just goes on and on and on.
Well, exactly. You can see the problem. You're asking like you wrote a novella. You can't do that.
It's horizontal scroll bars everywhere.
I know.
This is like
just, it's horribly formatted. It's way too long. It doesn't make any sense. Is it even a question? And then just close
the
fan.
This is the worst. This is the worst video game I've ever played. I'm sorry. I'm just laughing because one of the programmers here, Ben, wrote this application for the iPhone. And yep. The way the app works, it's called, I don't remember what it's called. You take a credit card and you hold it up against something and take a picture of it, and it tells you how big that something is.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because it knows how big your credit card is. Some kid in Australia wrote a review on the App Store saying, this is the worst game ever.
Awesome.
Wait. You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.